when we talk about bariatric surgery, what are we talking about?
So bariatric surgery describes a series of procedures that are designed to decrease food intake and decrease, in some cases, absorption of nutrients. And we're finding now, even more importantly, actually changing some of the local hormonal activities in the GI tract. And so there are several operations that have been proposed and have been performed to achieve one or more of those goals.
Are there one or two that are more common procedures that are done at this point?
So kind of the classic gold standard is the gastric bypass, which I think most people equate with bariatric surgery, mm-hmm. and that's done laparoscopically. But not only does it substantially reduce the size of the stomach, but also bypasses part of the intestine, which A, adds to the complexity and possible risks of the procedure, and B, adds to the potential for long-term nutritional consequences. But I think that would probably be considered classically the most common one. Now the most common operation, certainly in adolescents and also really I think in adults now, is the sleeve gastrectomy, which is a more recent procedure that was actually developed as a part of a much more complicated procedure. But this procedure itself involves taking a specially designed stapling device and removing most, say, 80 to 85% of the stomach, leaving a tube of stomach between, you know, the esophagus, the swallowing tube, and the intestines. But it does not involve rearranging any intestines, so there's no risk of malabsorption, which is where you get really severe diarrhea after eating sugar, and there's less risk of serious nutritional consequences. And so that's probably the most commonly performed procedure now.
And just to be clear, I mean, this isn't simply about controlling weight. The idea is also to mitigate issues that come with severe obesity over time.
Right. The terminology that we use now currently is metabolic and bariatric surgery. So these are really in many ways considered a metabolic operation, meaning that it really changes fundamentally how the body reacts to nutrition, makes insulin, and these are the things that drive most of the other health conditions that occur with severe obesity. And that's really our goal, is to improve the health of these patients, not just have them lose the weight. So that's exactly right.
And some of those health issues include what?
Diabetes. Actually, the used to be the type 1 diabetes was called juvenile onset. Well, now type 2 diabetes, which is the one usually associated with obesity, is now more common in children than adolescent or juvenile onset diabetes. So that's becoming a huge problem. Sleep apnea is a big issue with kids and can really cause major heart issues later. Liver disease, orthopedic issues, psychologic issues, and cardiac issues. High blood pressure, we see teenagers with high blood pressure, with abnormal cholesterol. So really everything that you think of as an adult that you're trying to keep control of as you age are really problems that we're already seeing in these young teenagers, and they will continue to get worse if something's not done.
How often is this type of procedure, this type of surgery done with children and adolescents compared to adults? Is it still more commonly done with adults?
Oh, it's far more commonly done in adults. It's hard to know exactly how many procedures are done in children, but we've been involved in some studies that estimate that it's probably somewhere in the 1,600 a year range throughout the country. In the adult world, that number is maybe 100,000. I'm not sure what exactly the adult number is at this point, but it's substantially higher, you know, by orders of magnitude. And if you kind of put that in the context of how many children and adolescents we believe in this country would be at least at the appropriate weight or BMI for this surgery, that's probably 4 to 4.5 million kids. So, you know, 1,600 a year is really not much.
I was going to say, why is that? I'll admit one of the things that I found just talking about this story in our newsroom was that the initial response is, well, is that something they should be doing to kids? Is this a good idea for kids? Is that the primary reason why maybe this is not used as much in younger people?
Let me guess. The comment was like, is he crazy? Is that what it was?
It wasn't quite that strong, but it was kind of like a very surprised reaction.
Yeah. But I've gotten that before, to be honest with you. And that is one of the main issues, I think, is there's a thought that really this is just, you know, baby fat, if you will. And if you just wait long enough, it'll go away, mm-hmm. or, you know, they'll grow into it, that they really aren't sick and you're doing, you know, preventative surgeries. So those are a lot of the comments that we've gotten in the past when we've talked about this. And I've been involved in this for, you know, going on 15 years now. So I've heard it all. But I think, you know, more fundamentally, there's a bias in society that obesity is a choice. And that's what we're trying to fight the most. I mean, it is a metabolic disease. It is partially genetically inherited. It's partially due to a lot of changes in our environment, the kinds of food we eat, the socioeconomic status of the families is very highly correlated with this. So it's not really just a lifestyle choice that people need to get over. And that's one of the big biases that that we've been fighting. And quite honestly, they fought it in the adult world too. But there are a couple of other reasons that very few procedures are done. First of all, if you look at the number of procedures are done, there aren't any places that are doing a lot of them. And so you've got several places just doing a couple. We probably are amongst the higher volume centers in the country doing them, and we don't do very many. And that's partly because there just aren't the resources available. So the requirements that we've put in the policy paper and that I've published in the past, you know, say that you really need to have a team of people who specialize in the care of children and adolescents with this problem. And there just aren't many of those, and they cost money. And then the final thing is, you know, currently many payers just won't pay for it because it's considered experimental, if you will. And so that was really one of the big drivers from my standpoint of wanting to come out with this policy statement, is to say, look, you know, these biases are not founded. We need to have quality centers that have the right resources, and we need to, as a society, decide we're going to treat this and pay for it.
So just building on that, why now for this policy statement? You talked about maybe some of the reasons why you wanted to say what you're saying and try to urge pediatricians and policymakers and insurers to improve access. Why is the timing right for this type of policy statement? And I guess what is your hope that people will take away from it?
Well, I think it's the merging of some really kind of important different issues, and we've reached critical mass in a lot of ways. So the Academy of Pediatrics formed the obesity section only about 10 or so years ago, maybe 15, certainly during my tenure with the Academy. And so really up until recently, it hasn't really been looked upon as a huge problem, but the number of severely obese adolescents has doubled in the past 20 years, and it shows no signs of abating. So it is clearly becoming a major epidemic, maybe even more so in kids than adults in terms of the rapid rise of it. In addition, there have been a couple of really well-designed prospective government-funded trials, one in the United States and one in Sweden, that have just published this year on their five-year outcome results on not only safety of the procedure and weight outcomes, but also outcomes in terms of disease reduction. So, you know, those came out this summer. The obesity section was formed 10 years ago. The initial goals for the obesity section were really to look at primary care and prevention, rightfully so. As the new leadership of the obesity section changed about 4 years ago, the new executive council was a group of pediatricians who were much more interested in this problem, the severe obesity. And so that's when we had the opportunity to partner with them. I would have never been able to do this if there was not a supportive group of pediatricians on the obesity section that supported it. So those are all things where timing just kind of came along properly. We've been working on this for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Honestly, we thought it was going to be out before this, but the Academy really takes a lot of thought, a lot of time to make sure that these policies address every issue and are really authoritative, because once they come out, pediatricians really look to it as, you know, ways that they should be practicing medicine.
I do want to circle back to kind of the process that individuals go through when they're considering this type of procedure. What are some of the factors that go into making that decision as to whether or not this is the right choice for a young person to go forward with this direction?
Sure. So there are criteria. There are indications and contraindications. Probably the most important indication that has been clarified with this policy statement is that we no longer have specific age criteria. When we first started doing bariatric surgery in teenagers, we were ultra conservative. You know, we set an age cutoff of 13 or 14. You know, the weight at which they would minimally qualify for a procedure was far higher than it would be in adults. And that was set based not really on any empiric data, but just to, quote, seem safe. You know what I mean? So really that we've been battling that for the last 15 years because that's more, 15 years, because that's really, you know, what everybody kind of grasped onto, particularly the payers, say, look, you know, this doesn't qualify according to your criteria. So we got rid of the age requirement now specifically. We don't have any data that doing this in younger individuals is detrimental. There are surgeons in other parts of the world who do them well under the age of 8 or 10. I think in this country it's probably not that common yet. But the other thing that was so important that really came out recently in these trials is that not only were they as effective as the procedures in adults, but what we found was that they were more effective at getting rid of the comorbid conditions than it was in adults. In other words, doing this procedure and dealing with the issues when you're younger makes it more likely that you're going to have a complete response. And even in the age groups between, say, 13 and 18, the longer you wait in that span, the likelihood of reducing that particular disease dropped by every year. So there's a lot of evidence that doing it earlier is going to be far better in terms of success rate. And finally, what we know is that no matter what operation you do, the maximum amount of weight a person is likely to lose is not more than a third to maybe 40% of their total weight. So if you weigh 300 pounds, you might lose 100 or 120 pounds, and that would get you where you need to get. If you wait till you're 400 pounds, you may never lose enough weight to become normal weight. So again, waiting till later, as people used to propose, we've found on many levels is not the right approach to this.
Having said that, I'm curious, you know, what happens post-procedure to kind of build on the surgery and kind of keep an individual moving in the right direction?
Right. So the critical point is the surgery is just a small tool in a very large armamentarium, if you will. So at minimum in our program here at DuPont, our children are involved with at least a six-month run-up to surgery where they initially don't even meet the surgeon. They meet our pediatrician, they meet a nutritionist, they meet an exercise physiologist. They meet a psychologist. Everybody gets evaluated by a psychologist. These are resources that many places just don't have available to them, and we have them readily available in our program. We also have a social worker available. We have a nurse coordinator. So we have everybody that we need. We have cardiologists in-house that specialize in cardiac problems in obese children if we need them. We have pulmonologists. We have endocrinologists. So everybody's here. And the first part of the program really is around helping them understand what needs to be done, working with the family. We have nutritional workbooks that they're required to complete, and they have to come regularly to appointments. And so once they've kind of gotten that pattern and they've really learned the correct nutritional tools and the correct lifestyle tools and dealt with any psychiatric comorbidities that there might be, then we begin to talk more seriously about the operation itself. The operation is, again, a fairly short period of time. It's a two-day hospitalization. But after they go home, they go back on a gradated diet. And at 7 weeks, we encourage them to get back to regular food. But they come here frequently to reinforce the nutrition, to reinforce the exercise, you know, to see a psychologist now and then if they need to. So the long-term follow-up and adherence to the guidelines is critical. Otherwise, you know, in the long haul, this is not going to be durable. And we see that in adults as well.
We've talked a lot about the data so far. I'm curious, what's your experience been personally with young people who've had this surgery?
So we have performed well over 150 bariatric procedures since we started. We started with the lap band in an FDA trial, and the lap band is not FDA approved, so we do not use that anymore. Our experience with that was that about a third of the kids did well and lost, you know, say 20 to, you know, 30 to 40% of their total weight, or, you know, 50% of excess weight and about a third of them lost a little bit of weight, and a third of them really had very little success at all. Since we've moved to the sleeve gastrectomy, and we've done between 80 and 90 of those at this point, the weight loss has been consistent and dramatic. Recognizing that not everybody comes in for follow-up for the long term, our most recent look at the data is that we have a 70% excess weight loss at 24 months, between 60 and 70%, which is, it hangs in there with the best of the data, both in pediatrics and in adults. And we're finding a similar success rate at getting rid of diabetes, sleep apnea, liver problems, orthopedic problems, what have you. So our experience very much mirrors that of other centers in the world.
Finally, what impact do you hope this new policy statement will ultimately have on this procedure, this surgery, and those that need it?
Great question. I mean, we really took some time to address this policy to three specific stakeholders, if you will. Maybe four, but three's for sure. The first is the pediatricians who practice in the community, and they really depend on these policy statements to guide how they manage their patients. You know, think about all the vaccine policy statements and the policy statements on car seats. They're important things that have come out that pediatricians adhere to. So that's the first group. We're trying to make it comfortable for them to make this decision and support not only, you know, referring their patients to places that can do these kinds of treatments, but really being part of the decision-making and part of the ongoing treatment plan. We don't want to take these patients away from their pediatricians. We just want to help them out through this portion of their life. So that's the first group. The second group really is talking to payers. You know, there's no question that there are medical directors of insurance plans who, you know, who currently do not, for whatever reason, pay for this procedure. Most of them are policies that their company has made, and that's fair enough. But really, their concern all along has been the longer-term outcomes, the complication rates. And so now we have a good, you know, solid 5 years of data on that that I'm hoping, once we get it in front of them, and that's the plan over the next couple of months, that it'll really change their approach to how they pay for this important service. And the third one is government agencies, right? CMS, you know, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, you know, Congress. I mean, we have to decide as a society that this is what we're going to do. We're going to take care of this segment, this growing segment of children who, you know, by the way, many of them are parts of ethnic and racial minorities. Many of them are socioeconomically disadvantaged. So this is really, you know, kind of an underserved, fragile part of society that needs all of our help. And so that's kind of the third piece of the statement. I don't know how much effect this is going to have on families and parents, but, you know, I'm thinking the more they know about this policy, the more they'll think about this as a possibility, too.
Dr. Reichert, we really appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.